issues, and with herbicides being used.
Good morning. I have to have full disclosure. I don't have a PhD, so I hope you don't think less of me because of that. But I do work for the University of California, and I'm a member of the Granite Canyon Research Group, which is part of the Department of Environmental Toxicology. And I've been a toxicologist for almost 30 years.
And no apologies, because, you know, higher education and education is learning how to learn, right?
Well, I've learned a lot in the last 30 years.
Exactly.
What I want to talk about today is, if you'll forgive me also, I have some last-minute notes because colleagues weighed in on what I should say today. But I just want to give a brief overview of what toxicity testing is, just to make sure that that's clear. I know we've referred to toxicity testing a couple of times this morning, so just to drive that point home. Then I'm also going to talk about the sensitivity of the species that we commonly use. The different species are sensitive to different chemicals, and how those species make up a comprehensive monitoring program. And then give some chemical properties that of the major pesticide players that we work with, and again how those chemical properties inform the type of monitoring program. There was a question earlier about sediment versus water. Those types of questions can be answered based on the chemical properties. And then just give a few data examples of what we've seen most recently in the last few years in terms of chemical detections and resulting toxicity, specifically for pesticides, in some areas that my lab's done work in, particularly in collaboration with Region 3 staff and the Department of Pesticide Regulation. So I was at a roundtable meeting as part of the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program recently, and a number of staff members from other regions expressed difficulty in understanding aquatic toxicity, and I actually asked for a show of hands, you know, if people could say, what's your difficulty in understanding toxicity? Because I come from a long line of poor Welsh coal miners, and, you know, the whole canary in a coal mine thing really drives the point home for me. These are surrogate species that are being used to give an indication of whether or not there's some kind of environmental effect. And if we take an aquatic species and we put it into a jar of water or a container of sediment with some overlying water, and we monitor whether or not they live or die or how well they grow or develop, we can get some indication of what's going on in that water sample or sediment sample. And the thing that I like about aquatic toxicity is it gives this aggregate toxicity measurement. So it gives an indication of what's going on in the sample, regardless of what mixture of contaminants are in that sample. And so it gives you an effect based on that mixture, rather than analyzing a single contaminant in that sample. So I mentioned that we can measure a number of biological effects. There's the acute effect is survival, but there's a number of chronic effects that we can measure depending on the organism. Reproduction, growth, development. Generally, the chronic effects are more sensitive than the acute effects. And then I just have a few organisms here that are commonly used. I've put their common names here, fathead minnows and the water flea, Ceridaphnia dubia. These are sort of the workhorses that are part of EPA 3 species testing. And the third leg of that three species test I don't have pictured here. It's a single celled alga that I'm not going to be talking about today. More recently, we've added this amphipod called Hylella azteca, and also a midgefly larva called Chironomus dilutus. These are some newer organisms that have been around for a long time in the EPA books, but their application to water column testing is a little bit more recent. So this slide's a little bit complex, but it's the solubility and persistence of some representative insecticides. And what I've done here is just to try to give some indication of how the chemicals, the active ingredients in particular, relate to one another. In this first column here, I have a list of four representative chemicals. DDT represents the organochlorines. Chlorpyrifos represents the organophosphates. Bifenthrin is a pyrethroid. And imidacloprid, as you've heard already, is one of the newer neonicotinoids. And we look at these chemicals based on how soluble they are in the water, how easily they're going to dissolve and be transported via water, versus how likely they are to adsorb and associate with particles and be associated with sediments, say. So these first two columns here, you heard Shin talk about log KOW or KOC. These are coefficients that give indications about how soluble a chemical is or how likely it is to bind to organic carbon or particles in general. And essentially, the higher the number is, the more likely it's not going to be in solution, that it's going to be associated with sediment. So DDT is the classic example of that. The log KOW is a pretty high number. And remember, this is a logarithmic scale, so 6 is quite a bit higher than 4.7. And then that 2 million number for the KOC says that DDTs, you're going to see it in sediment. And so if you go to measure DDT in water, I'm not saying that there's not going to be a little bit of DDT in water, but if there is DDT in water, it's going to be looking for a particle to stick to. That molecule will rather stick to a particle. So transport for these types of chemicals is generally via the movement of sediment as opposed to just the flow of water. Removing sediment from the water column in like a management practice, therefore, would help remove some of these chemicals from that transport system. So DDT is no longer used, but we still see it a lot because these half-lives are really long. The half-lives are in the years. So there's a soil half-life and then a couple of different water half-lives up here based on two different breakdown pathways, photolysis and hydrolysis. And these, regardless of these pathways of breakdown, DDT hangs out for a long time. That's why we're still seeing DDT in environmental samples today. And a good thing to point out, and DDT again is a good example of this, when DDT breaks down, it doesn't just disappear, it breaks down into other chemicals that can be, in some cases, more toxic than the parent compound. For DDT, it breaks down into DDE and DDD, and you talk about multisyllabic names, I mean, those are like 20 syllables with some numbers in them too, and I can never remember what they are, but these chemicals, in the case of the DDT breakdown products, are more toxic than the parent compound. So more recently, chlorpyrifos has been used more recently than DDT. The organophosphates sort of replaced the organochlorines to a large extent, and it is more soluble and less likely to stick to particles. And so we'll see this chemical in the water column and in sediment. Its half-life is on the order of days, and as you may or may not be aware, chlorpyrifos usage, being an organophosphate, has gone down quite a bit in recent years with the increased use of the pyrethroids. And so I have bifenthrin here. Bifenthrin harkens back to sort of the DDT properties in terms of whether or not it's going to be in the water column or in sediment. All the pyrethroids are very sticky, they're hydrophobic, and they're more likely to be associated with sediment. But that being said, we do see some free concentrations in the water and can see effects in the water column as well. Bifenthrin is one of the most long-lived pyrethroids, and it hangs out on the order of months to years in some cases. Lastly, we have imidacloprid. Imidacloprid is very, very soluble. It is very, very unlikely to associate with particles. And because of that, it's a little bit more difficult to remove from the water column via normal pest management practices. It does have a short half-life, and I'm not really clear on the toxicity of its breakdown products. Some of that research is still being conducted. So I just alluded to a little bit of insecticide history, and this is a timeline from the 50s to the present day, and these decades are sort of approximations of when these chemicals were, I would say, the peak of their usage spans these dates. Obviously, we're still using chlorpyrifosfate, we're still detecting it, and so we're this bar should extend to the present day, but it's being used less than it was in the past. But this is a likely progression of how things have gone as, again, as technology has improved, as chemicals have become developed, and formulations become more more efficient, I should say. I've added phenylpyrazoles in here just for reference. Fipronil is an urban use chemical. It's not really what we're talking about today, but it does play a role in our timeline and in the urban monitoring that my laboratory does for the surface water ambient monitoring program. With the toxicity test organisms, they've sort of evolved along with this chemistry timeline. So early on in my career, we were doing tests with fathead minnows, and we were using fathead minnows, which is a freshwater fish. We were using adult fathead minnows to test ocean discharges in San Diego. And I always thought that was strange because I felt we should be using an ocean organism. And as time has progressed, the ocean plan went into effect, and now we have indigenous ocean organisms that are used for marine discharges, things like the sea urchin and the mysid shrimp, and we're using those instead of fathead minnows. So we're trying to have the toxicity test monitoring of agricultural chemicals, or I should say insecticides, whether they're used in agriculture or urban environments. We're trying to have the monitoring of these chemicals also evolve appropriately. Now, organophosphates, the Ceridaphnia, the water flu, is very sensitive to organophosphates and was a perfect organism for detecting these chemicals in the water column. There's a number of papers from 20 years ago that talk about toxicity identification evaluation methods, looking at ways to identify OPs related to the survival and reproduction of these daphnids. And I know that that led to regulation. Recently, my colleague Brian Anderson, who also doesn't have a PhD, published a paper on the changing patterns of pesticide use and how those changing patterns have reflected changes in regulation and how, in some cases, the changes in regulation and policy can sort of force the changes in those in insecticide uses. And it's very likely, that this timeline will continue with more colored boxes of other chemicals that are going to be used in decades to come. But what we know to date is, as we've moved through this system, as we started testing, as we started using pyrethroids, again, urban and agricultural usage, we found that this amphipod crustacean, this Hyalella azteca, is the most sensitive to the pyrethroids. Now, this organism, and the next one, the midgefly larva, these are indigenous organisms. They're native to California streams, and they're even better than that canary. They're truly representative of what's going on in streams. And work we've done at our laboratory is also linked inputs of toxic runoff to effects in the streams. So doing bioassessment in streams above and below toxic inputs that are toxic to all three of these organisms, show that there's clear effects below the inputs. So we know we have direct linkages between what's going on to inputs to, say, the Salinas River to the resident biota. Another way to look at the sensitivity of these organisms is to look at their 96-hour LC50s. And an LC50 is a median lethal concentration. And this is the concentration, if you expose an animal to this concentration of, say, chlorpyrifos for Ceridaphnia, if you expose a Ceridaphnia to 54 nanograms per liter, that's parts per trillion, you'll have about half of your organisms die. So that's the median lethal concentration. And we use 96 hours, or I should say I've used 96 hours in this table, because that's the end point that I could get the most numbers for, so we can have some comparisons. There's 48-hour LC50s. There's 10-day LC50s. There's 40-day EC50s. It goes on and on. There's a number of different endpoints for any particular organism, but not all of them are known. In fact, you can still see, you know, I have a number here, a question mark here rather than a number. And to be honest, this number right here, you can ignore that number. We've discovered recently it's incorrect. So even though this came out of a published paper from the last decade, there's a problem with that number. So recent work in my laboratory has demonstrated that this number should be quite a bit higher than it is. So focusing on the gray boxes here, these I've grayed out the most sensitive number for each chemical class. And so water flea, you know, very sensitive to chlorpyrifos, our hyalella amphipod, very sensitive to bifenthrin, and then the midge fly larva is our leader for being sensitive to imidacloprid. One thing to point out with these organisms also is the mode of action. So I'm just going to back up real quick just so we can look at pictures of the critters. The water flea and the amphipod, these are crustaceans. And although all three of these invertebrates are arthropod invertebrates, these two are crustaceans, and this one's an insect. And the mode of action of the chemicals is different between crustaceans and insects. The reason this midge fly larva is so sensitive to imidacloprid is because of the receptors in that organism. Imidacloprid acts on those receptors in a cumulative manner. So it's essentially an irreversible process. So once those receptors are bound by the imidacloprid molecule, it's unlikely the animal's going to recover. You have a certain amount of recovery with the crustaceans and with the chemicals that they're sensitive to. So there's different modes of action as well. And that's borne out in this slide right here. So this is focusing on imidacloprid toxicity. And what I wanted to focus on here is to demonstrate, there's that 2650 from the last slide. I want to demonstrate how the longer you do the exposure, the lower that 50%, that median number is going to get, whether it's a 50% to lethal or a 50% to effect. So just looking at death, 96 to 14 day to 28 day, those numbers become more and more sensitive. And these are all experimental numbers that were derived in laboratories with measured doses of these chemicals and with the organism in the lab. We have a 40-day emergence endpoint. So since these are fly larvae, they actually emerge and fly away at the end of the exposure. And the emergence median concentration is 390 parts per trillion. Now, the last four lines here, the last four rows, have the EPA acute and chronic benchmarks, and as Shin pointed out, these benchmarks are based on the most sensitive organisms that have been tested. And in this case, it's for pesticides, it's almost always the invertebrates. And so these numbers are based on the invertebrate tests. And that EPA benchmark of 385 is pretty reflective. This is an acute benchmark. It's pretty reflective of this emergence EC50, but the chronic benchmark is 10, and that's 10 nanograms per liter. It's 10 drops in the Olympic-sized swimming pool. It's very, very low concentration. For reference, also, I included some work by Morrissey, who's a researcher from Canada, just to give a bit of an international flavor, and they've done a review paper looking at neonicotinoids around the world. And they come up with their own recommendations for protective, acute and chronic protective values that are pretty much in the ballpark of what EPA is recommending. So the point I'm trying to make with all of this is to demonstrate how imidacloprid works with longer and longer exposures, which are likely to happen in the environment, but also to say that if we were just going to look at a 96-hour LC50 and to use that as some bright line, as a water quality number, it could be underprotective of the organisms in the environment. Now, if we're doing some 96-hour tests in our laboratory and we want to see, is the imidacloprid concentration in that sample, how does it compare to the 96-hour exposure I just did, then this number would be a good number to compare to. But in terms of environmental protection over the long term, I think some of these lower numbers would be a little bit more protective. So shifting gears, I want to talk a little bit about some data that we've collected over the years. And this is the next few slides are data since 2014. And so this is the Brian Anderson paper that I just mentioned. It just came out, and it's been very popular. And it represents some data that we collaborated with Region 3 on and with DPR. So essentially, DPR goes out and does their monitoring every year, as Shin described. And they did some monitoring in Region 3 a few years ago, and Region 3 had some extra funding to give us to do toxicity testing along with the DPR monitoring. And so this first column here are the stations that that DPR sampled. The paper actually covers some work done in Region 7 as well, if you want to see how we juxtaposed the what we found in Region 3 versus what we found in Region 7. But today we're focusing on Region 3 for obvious reasons. So within these two larger boxes are the results for our high alella exposures. This is our amphipod, and Chironomus, the fly larva, the midge larva. And we did 10-day exposures for both of these. So these are exposures that are a little bit more sensitive than a 96-hour exposure, but we're still measuring survival, an acute endpoint. And so the first column within each of these boxes is the survival number, and the gray box means that there was a significant reduction in survival at that site. The water samples are exactly the same for both boxes. They were tested synoptically. And then the pyrethroid analyses and the imidacloprid analyses from those water samples are represented in both of these boxes by toxic units. And if you can hang with me through this, a toxic unit, a single toxic unit, is representative of an LC50 concentration. So if you think about a 96-hour LC50 concentration, or in this case, a 10-day LC50 concentration, if you have that much of a chemical in this sample, it's one toxic unit. And you would expect to see 50% survival with one toxic unit. So I've grayed out the boxes that have greater than half a toxic unit, just to give us some indication that we might be seeing an effect from that chemical. And it pretty much bears out. In the high-low test, it's sensitive to pyrethroids, and if we have toxic units that are greater than 0.5, we're pretty much bound to see some significant reduction of survival. Those toxic units represented over here for Chironomus, the numbers are going to be different because Chironomus have a different LC50. We use a different LC50 to calculate these TUs. And so those toxic units are actually quite a bit lower than these because these guys are not as sensitive to pyrethroids. There's still a couple that are above 0.5, and we see some effect in the survival. But for the most part, the imidacloprid numbers represented as toxic units wrap into what's going on with the survival numbers. So if we were to just measure toxicity with one of these organisms instead of the other, we might miss something. And you can see that with the results of Solomon Creek. There was 98% survival with our amphipod, but 0% survival with Chironomus. And that's because there was a bunch of imidacloprid in that sample, and the amphipods aren't sensitive to imidacloprid. So by using both organisms, we were able to capture some more information here about Solomon Creek. We were able to determine that Solomon Creek is, in fact, toxic, whereas if we just used a single organism, it wouldn't be seen as such. So the next couple of slides sort of illustrate that point to varying degrees. This is some other collaborative monitoring we did with DPR at Orcutt Creek, and going back a slide, you can see Orcutt Creek right here was previously toxic to both organisms. And so we measured toxicity, this was a couple of years later, in 2016, and this time around we didn't have any toxicity to high alella, but we did have toxicity to Chironomus in all three samples. And it's interesting also because when we looked over at the pyrethroids, we didn't have enough money to do chemistry sampling right here, but we have it for the first and the third run. There were no pyrethroids detected in these samples, but there was a little bit of imidacloprid. And so again, these are nanograms per liter, parts per trillion. And the previous slide I showed that had a concentration range of about 170 nanograms to liter to 9,000 nanograms per liter. And this fits right into that ballpark. We have about 1,000 and 1,500, and we definitely saw some Coronis toxicity. We think that those numbers are probably enough to cause some problems in a 10-day test. And we were able to throw in one pseudodaphnine test just to see if we could pick up toxicity with cereals. And in this case, we did. And we didn't see anything in the chemistry to show a cause of that toxicity. Could have been a little bit of this malathion, but that was the only organophosphate pesticide that we measured in this. Now, there's a lot of chemicals, and these are DPR measurements done at the CDFA lab, and they have an analyte list that they follow, and it might have been something that wasn't measured as part of CDFA's analyte list. I wanted to juxtapose some Santa Maria data with some data from Monterey County. These are some samples collected in Monterey County, and this shows the exact opposite. It shows we had a Hialeah hit and no Coronimus hits, and our imidacloprid numbers were quite a bit lower. They were in the order of 23 to 135 nanograms per liter. So up in the Monterey County area, I guess there's less imidacloprid, lower concentrations being detected in the receiving systems. There was this 32 nanogram per liter pyrethroid concentration, and that was more than enough to cause toxicity right here. So the point I'm trying to make again is that, you know, it using these multiple organisms allow us to detect a little bit more information than we otherwise would. The last data example I have is, I believe these are samples from all over Region 3. And it was stuff that we did in October 17 and January of this year. And I don't have any chemistry yet to show with this toxicity data, but the point I'm trying to make is we did three species testing: Hialeah, the amphipod, Coronimus, our fly larva, and Ceridaphnia, that water flea. And if you look in that Ceridaphnia column, if you just did Ceridaphnia tests, you would have only detected a single toxic sample out of all of these samples. But we had 3 of 11 toxic to Coronimus and 4 of 11 toxic to Hialeah. And again, you know, we have these toxicity to Hialeah, but not toxic to the other two, or toxic to Coronimus, but not toxic to the other two, toxic to Cereo. And so in moving forward with any well-designed monitoring program, if you're going to include toxicity as a component, you would want to have multiple species to try to capture as much information as you can. I'm a little bit biased because I'm a toxicologist, but I also feel that in the long run, because of these organisms' ability to detect bioavailable components of the contaminants, I think you get more bang for your buck than trying to pay for the level of chemistry that you would need to detect these concentrations at such a low level where they're toxic. So just to summarize, insecticide use continues to change, and I think that the focus of monitoring should be on current use active ingredients, and evolving monitoring programs should always have species that can detect new chemicals. Shin mentioned best management practices. We're working to try to design best management practices on field scale that can handle all of the pesticides that we know about to date. But the management practices should be informed by things like the monitoring that DPR is doing and the modeling that DPR is doing as well. And they should be consistently updated. Just having something as simple as a sedimentation basin can help with the removal of pyrethroids, but moving on to more advanced systems that are going to collect the more soluble chemicals. We've been working with granulated activated carbon to try to pull those soluble chemicals out of the water if they're running off the field. Ideally, the water stays on the field, but you know, you can't always make that happen. And If the water does get off the field, we're trying for the simplest methods possible to remove the chemicals from the water. And that's all I have. Thanks.
So I'll start all the way on my left with Jane.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. So I just had some questions because I, too, like my colleague, was interested in the bioreactors and the efficacy of chips to
right.
act as a filter and what your research has indicated.
Well, part of the data I just showed you was part of Mary's funding. She had some extra money to run out and do some toxicity testing before the money expired. And we actually did some tox tests on the multi-channel bioreactor that Shin showed. And we showed that the wood chips do clean up pyrethroids and that the data is really preliminary right now. You know, I have to stare at it a little bit longer to make sure it can be released. But it shows a complete reduction of pyrethroid concentrations. So the wood chips, you know, because the pyrethroids are hydrophobic, they're going to stick to stuff, and the wood chips provide a perfect basis for that. Another section of that multi-channel bioreactor that they were working on included a floating vegetation, and I know there was a question about plant material earlier.
Yeah, I was going to follow up with vegetative buffers.
Right, yeah, vegetation can serve the same purpose in some regards for the more hydrophobic, sticky contaminants. You know, it just creates a surface area for the contaminant to adhere to, and it gives an opportunity for that pesticide, once it adheres to that surface area, to break down. So rather than getting out into a receiving system and causing problems with the resident organisms, you know, you're sort of sequestering it in an area where it can break down. And so we're hoping that we don't know what the nature of that breakdown is going to be in a bioreactor, because bioreactors are sort of engineered to get rid of the nitrates, and there's a bacterial component. I'm not sure how that bacteria is going to work to break down the chemical, but we do know that it's creating surface area for the chemical to stick. There's going to be some, I'm doing some monitoring on a bioreactor in Watsonville this summer. So we're going to have a before the bioreactor, after the bioreactor, and then we're going to have a granulated activated carbon component that we're going to monitor as well. So it'll be three points in the system that we can monitor. So we'll see how it removes all of the chemicals we've been talking about.
Okay, and as it relates to vegetative buffers, are you looking at different types of vegetation and different types of materials? Also, you know, the size, the width, anything like that?
Yeah, there's definitely no one-size-fits-all for a vegetative buffer. You know, it depends a lot on the acreage that's being farmed, if you're putting it in an agricultural setting. So it depends on acreage, depends on chemical use, it depends on cropping, and it depends on irrigation practices. And we've been looking at, we've been doing some work on a test farm in Salinas, the USDA test farm, and they're using a grass that's red fescue because it grows pretty easily and the seeds are small and it doesn't create a habitat problem for food safety issues. So it's, again, it's almost just like if you can have some kind of surface area there, it's probably going to be advantageous. We've even tried substituting grasses with shredded plastic, you know, just as a way of completely avoiding the food safety issue. Like, what if we didn't have grass? What if we just had a bunch of shredded plastic there? Would it work the same way? And it more or less does, but grasses are sort of more perennial unless you don't have to try to get rid of it, you know, when you're done.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Delgado?
Yes, thank you for the great presentation. When you have pyrethroids, such as bifenthrin or DDT that strongly adsorb to the molecules strongly absorb to sediment particles. How do they detach to become harmful to organisms?
That's like a chemistry question. So you know, there's like an equilibrium partitioning. You know, once you know, we think about it like with carbon. If you're using carbon filtration, you know, like we use carbon filtration the same way you would use a Brita filter on the counter at home. You know, you're pouring your water through, it's removing the odors and the chemicals from your water. At some point, you have to change the filter because all of the binding sites are full. And as water passes through that filter, it's not going to adhere. The stuff, bad stuff in the water is not going to adhere to that filter anymore. Conversely, if you poured ultra clean water through that filter, you could have some preferential removal of those chemicals from the binding sites depending on how tightly they've bound to the particles. Pyrethroids, if you have a glass container of a sample you've just collected, the pyrethroids will associate with the side of the container all you have to do to get them off the side of the container is shake the bottle. They sort of loosely associate. They don't have a strong binding affinity, whereas something like DDT would have a stronger binding affinity to the side of the container. So it's all kind of a variable, constantly moving target about what's gonna come off of the sediments in any given situation. Contaminated sediments are always known as a source and a sink. So they can be, you know, as the sediments drop out of the system, they can become a sink, and they can be sort of removed from the water column and be less bioavailable. But at some point, they can also be a source of those contaminants to the water column, just with a reverse chemical process.
Such as during disturbance.
And during disturbance, yeah. If you mobilize those sediments, if you shake them up and you get them back into the water column, you can have some desorption of those contaminants back into the water column.
Okay. You mentioned that pyrethroids can be less strongly associated with solids. But I thought that your table showing the log of KOW showed that like DDT and bifenthrin had the same association.
Right. That's their solubility. So that's their ability to dissolve into water. Their ability to sorb onto surfaces is in this column right here. It's in the KOC column. And that's an organic carbon coefficient. So organic carbon is used as a catch-all measurement, but it does reflect also how they would absorb, to say, a piece of sand or a piece of silt in the system, or the glass wall of a container.
Okay, so in that case, between TDT and bifenthrin.
Yeah, 2 million versus 240,000.
So it's almost 10 times more strongly associated with solids DDT is than...
Right.
Bifenthrin.
Yeah, I'm sure it's more complicated than that from the chemistry standpoint, but I'm unable to explain it to you beyond what I've already said.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Young?
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. So following up on what Mr. Delgado was asking you, so physical disturbance can mobilize these chemicals that are bound to sediment.
Right.
How about changes in temperature or pH or sunlight or any other factors?
Sunlight plays a role in the breakdown of the chemical. So, you know, generally speaking, you know, your soil half-lives are going to be longer than your water half-lives. I say generally. I mean, we have 3 to 8 months for bifenthrin versus 9 to 14 for photolysis. But if you look at, say, like imidacloprid, if it's stuck in soil, it has a very long half-life, you know, on the order of months versus just a few hours in water. So that answers the sunlight question. The pH question, I'm sure that plays a role, but I'm unclear as to how that chemical process works for all of these chemicals individually. And then to answer the question about temperature, I think generally speaking, temperature is not going to play a role as to how the chemical moves off of particles or back into solution. But in terms of toxicity with the pyrethroids, at colder temperatures, they are more toxic to the organism. And it's not because of anything that the temperature is doing to the chemical. It's what the temperature is doing to the organism and its ability to metabolize the chemical. It has a harder time. Its metabolic pathways that would detoxify a pyrethroid, they get slowed down at colder temperatures, and it causes the pyrethroids to become more toxic. So many of the toxicity tests we conduct in the laboratory are done at about anywhere from 20 to 25 degrees Celsius. And, I mean, the environment is probably quite a bit colder than that in a lot of places. I think the average temperature across the state for the surface water ambient monitoring program was about 15 degrees. So it's likely, you know, if we have a single concentration of bifenthrin in the lab, it's probably less toxic than it would be on the field, depending on the setting, of course.
Why not use 15 degrees?
Well, you'd have to take that up with the EPA. They've called for, in the case of the Coronimus test and the Hylala test, they've called for 23. There's been some researchers that have used 15 degrees, and we do use a cold temperature test as a diagnostic to determine if pyrethroids are contributing to toxicity. Stream Pollution Trends program, which is a statewide sediment program that we administer. We did a subset of our 100 sites at 15 degrees, I think for 4 years in a row, and pretty much demonstrated, I want to say like a fourfold increase in toxicity at all the sites because of the presence of pyrethroids.
Different question. Chronic means chronic for that group of individuals in the sample over their lifetime, or does it get into their reproduction or their fecundity and how well they are going to reproduce over time? Because I can just imagine.
Good question.
You've got, you know, I mean, your 96, 14, and 28 day, the 96 hour, 14 day, 28 day suggests to me that, it takes more chemical to kill in the short term.
Right.
And it takes less chemical to kill over the long term.
Right.
And that is kill. That is not a reduction in fecundity.
Right.
And reproduction success.
Yeah, so the emergence endpoint's probably a more accurate reflection of that, because these flies are emerging to go off and reproduce. And so if you're, you know, if you're down here at 390 and you're reducing the emergence by half at 390, then you're reducing the next generation immediately by half, or at least the F1, as they say, you know, it's the next generation of eggs. It's going to be fewer eggs being laid by the adult flies.
So,
but yeah, this is, when I say chronic in a toxicity sense, we look at it as chronic within this 28 days or chronic within this 40 days. It's more difficult to extrapolate to a life cycle assessment. You know, at multiple generations, there have been some researchers that have looked at that. They've done like mesocosm studies where they'll look at multiple generations of an organism in a dosed slice of the environment, you know, a large tank that contains plants and sediment and flowing water. And there's definitely long-term chronic effects that can affect the future generations. The pseudadapnea test actually measures reproduction as one of its endpoints. And so you can look, even within the space of 7 or 8 days, you can look at whether or not the animal's reproducing enough. And if you see a 50% effect in reproduction just within 7 days, that's pretty significant.
Interesting. How did EPA come up with 10?
You know, Sarah Lopez was talking to me about that earlier this morning, and I can't really answer that question. I know they have a built-in safety factor, but it is based in part upon the most sensitive invertebrate tested from a large data set. A large data set's been gathered from all the different tests that have been done in the literature, and they pick the most sensitive number, and they usually build a 10x safety factor into that number. So this 10 would indicate that the chronic number, or the chronic LC50, if you will, or medium lethal concentration, would be about 100 if there was a 10x.
Thank you. There.
Mr. Thompson?
Just a couple of questions. When you talk about aerobic half-life, soil half-life aerobic, what happens when you have sediment that is under the water? Is that like in the bottom of Bosa Flacco Lake or the lakes up around Watsonville? Is that half-life, the soil half-life, or the sediment half-life? The soil half-life, rather, or the water half-life?
I think there are sediment half-lives as well. They're just not as well-known. A lot of these half-lives are experimentally derived. And, again, I probably left sediment half-life out of this because of a lack of a complete data set for all four contaminants. But I believe there are sediment half-lives measured as well that are specific to, you know, soil that is underwater.
And I would assume that if that was anaerobic, it would be a longer half-life than aerobic. Is that a safe assumption by and large or not?
I think that would be chemical dependent.
Okay. And my other question, going back to the slide that's toxicity and current use insecticides 2014, the one that listed all the different creek samples.
This one.
Yeah. I was kind of curious, looking, for example, at the top number, the top set of results in the Geronimus. I see zero survival rate and
right.
toxic units that amount to about, if you add them together, 0.64.
Right.
Now, if those are the only toxicities, I would expect that you would get a 50% survival rate with a toxicity unit of 1, right?
Right.
So does that basically just tell us that there are probably some other toxic chemicals in there?
Correct.
Okay.
Also, keep in mind that we're dealing with biology, and there's an inherent amount of variability
okay.
in the organism response. And I'm always trying to tell people that, you know, some researchers will do toxic unit analyses and have this really bright line, and other researchers will do it, and it'll be a big mess. And it depends a lot on the animal. You know, their
how
it's feeling that day.
All right. Thank you.
All right, so I have a general question, but I'm going to hold it off because I want to, as a courtesy, give the opportunity to my two speaker card holders to comment and take the advantage that we still have all three of you speakers here. So I want to thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
So I will start with Claire. No, you can both. That's fine. Because I want to make sure that, you know, there's a linkage with our speakers that we had, Claire, so there's not a disconnect. So we have 3 minutes.
Hi, good morning. My name is Claire Wyden. I'm the president of the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo Counties. I'd like to start by reminding the board of the strict regulatory oversight of the use of plant protection materials. Layers of regulation include US EPA, California Department of Pesticide Regulations, and County Ag Commissioners. Applications are scheduled in coordination with recommendations from licensed pest control advisors and with reporting to the County Ag Commissioner. I'd like to speak to some of the big picture trends and factors influencing the use of these materials. It's very, very difficult to get new products registered. It's a multi-year and multi-million dollar process. Product registrations and labeling are reviewed regularly by the regulatory agencies. Label restrictions are by crop type, and it can be very difficult to get products labeled for this use for the specialty crops that we grow on the Central Coast as opposed to a commodity like corn or soy. We need plant protection materials to be able to commercially grow food crops and take the responsible stewardship for continued use of plant protection materials very seriously. It's essential to rotate active ingredients, classes, and mode of actions, or how the material works to prevent resistance. The development of resistance is detrimental to all involved. For these reasons, we're supportive of having a wide variety of plant protection materials available to PCAs and farmers to reduce the risk of developing resistance. Next, I'd like to speak to the issue of concentration and concentration-based exceedances. Many of the results discussed are assessed in concentration. The Santa Maria watershed has relatively low flow rates, especially natural base flows, in the way that other watersheds on the Central Coast do, which can result in higher concentrations. Would also like to remind you that many of the constituents are measured in parts per billion with a B and trillion with a T, which is a very high level of precision that wasn't technologically feasible before. It's certainly not our intention to sound dismissive of the importance of multiple beneficial uses and water quality parameters, but we do hope that you look at the information being presented to you in context. Finally, the board touched on this earlier, but I'd like to make sure that the board also perfectly understands the measure of pounds of active ingredient. Some of the older products work great with a single application and had a longer effective duration, but due to policy and other considerations are now used less. Some of the newer products are less persistent and might require multiple applications to achieve the same, or in many cases, lesser control. As the board discussed previously, the pounds of active ingredient applied might or might not correspond with water quality impacts. For these reasons, we support having a wide variety of plant protection materials available and focusing on implementing pesticide use and other management practices that are protective of water quality. Agriculture is a very different world than it was 10 years ago. Irrigation management technology and practices have continued to improve, as have plant protection application technologies and understanding of management practices. We hope that this information further informs your deliberations today and moving forward in the regulation of irrigated lands. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. And Harry? Our timer's not working, Tammy? Okay.
I'll be very short. I'm Harry Clausen. I'm a peach and nectarine grower that happened to be in the audience today. I've been filling out pesticide use reports for 26 years for my farming operation. I know there was a question about the reporting and the requirements for pesticide use. So as a grower, we are responsible to get a applicator permit from the county ag commissioner to purchase pesticides from an ag retailer. Part of that requirement is that when we apply a pesticide, we need to report in a form developed by Department of Pesticide Regulation to our county ag commissioners every month, the 10th day of the following month of the application. We need to submit our pesticide use report. So about 10 days ago, I finished my use reports for my February pesticide applications. On that report, we have to put the product name, the EPA name, the amount of total product that we use per acre, and the total amount we use per that whole field spray application. So when we fill out that form, we also put the EPA number and the product name, which the county ag commissioner converts into the active ingredient name. They take that data as a county, aggregate the data, submit it to DPR, and then you see the results of the use information that the previous speaker gave. Now, if you use a California restricted use product, which is some of the pyrethroids, I don't believe chlorpyrifos is, oh, it just changed to California restricted use. Before I make an application, 48 hours in advance, I have to submit a notice of intent to apply a restricted use pesticide. So the use of these products, restricted use, is quite a bit being demotivated, if you will, because a notice of intent could trigger an inspection by the county ag commissioner, and there are other restrictions that are required. And then the one product that was mentioned, the five-syllable product, AI, that I've
learned. The five-syllable one?
Yes, the longer one is Intrepid Insecticide. It is an insecticide that's considered an oocide, larvicide, so it works on the worms, if you will, of invertebrates, especially these cabbage loopers and other insects that attack vegetables on the Central Coast. It is a very good rotation product for a lot of the organophosphates, pyrethroids, and others. So growers are trying to switch to preserve use of these products and the resistance of those products. So that may be why there's an increased use of those products lately. So that's
the
presentation.
Yeah, I appreciate you providing everyone this clarification. And then, you know, the other aspect to your permit with the Ag Commissioner is the human exposure for the applicator and then any party. So you do have to post, you know, reentry, and you have prohibited reentry periods.
Correct,
depending
yes.
the type of product used. So,
and personal protective equipment
exactly.
that you wear
mm-hmm.
and such. So all those go into the decision of the products we use. The other product that you saw that had some spikes in methylmil is called lanate. This is a very short residual aphid material that is used on lettuce, many, many crops. And a lot of times that will be used if we have warm weather in the spring and we see an immediate aphid outbreak. You'll use this product, get quick knockdown, and you have a two-day pre-harvest interval. In other words, right before you're getting ready to harvest the field, you can use this product. and EPA has pre-harvest intervals that allow you to use that product. And we've had some pretty bad aphid years in Central Coast with lettuce, broccoli, and the other crops, major crops that we grow.
Thank you, Peter. Any further question, comment?
I just have a quick one.
We'll start with Mayor Delgado, and then you can be last.
Yes, Claire repeatedly used the words plant protection materials. Is that the same thing as pesticides?
That's a broad category, a term used for crop protection chemicals, plant protection chemicals. And the other thing that always gets me as a former journalist, pesticides are inclusive of insecticides for bugs, fungicides for fungus, herbicides for weeds, and rodenticides for rodents. So when you say pesticides and insecticides, that's redundant.
Right. So pesticides equals plant protection materials?
Correct.
Okay. This is a comment not so much for Perry, but for following up on what Claire's comments were. Claire mentioned a couple things that technology allows us to detect smaller and smaller concentrations of pesticides, and that they're needed. And my thought when I heard that was that the whole point of technological advances is so that we can try to protect the toxicity or the death happening to the riparian ecology. So it's a good thing that we're able to detect toxic chemicals at lower concentrations that are killing life, because we're trying to protect the life of the ecosystem and the rivers, correct? So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Mr. Young?
My question was answered.
Okay. So at this time, again, I'd like to thank our speakers and also the additional input provided by our two speaker cards.